Good morning, Richa Hushing, and welcome to our studio. Today we have a pleasure to host you, and you are the director of Nicobar A Long Way.
Yes, yeah. It's a pleasure being here to talk to you.
Thank you. You're excited?
I am, because... Tonight is the screening. It was Nicobar A Long Way that got us to Auroville. The screening was on 22nd April, and we came and we chose to be here. And now, after 6 months, it's screening again. It's amazing.
And you are newcomers?
Not yet, in the process.
You're in the process. Yeah, yes. I remember when you came and you were really fascinated. The whole family, right?
Yes, yes.
And the Nicobar A Long Way, it's actually a family production, right? Because your husband is also... Ribu is...
He's a cinematographer and an associate director. It was both of us. And then our daughter, who was 9 months old then. So... Yeah, because it was a very tight budget and it's a protected area. So it was difficult to get the permissions to get into the islands just for both of us. We did not even try getting the permits for the assistants or anybody else because we could not have managed. We were there on the islands for over 9 months over a period of 2 years. So the only feasible way to do it was this way, that, you know, we manage it among us, within both of us.
So the movie is talking about Nicobar with all its own particularities, with tribes probably.
Yeah.
Sorry, I haven't seen the movie yet.
Yeah, you please see it tonight. The film is about... The Andaman and Nicobar group of islands are about 1,200 kilometers from the east coast of India in the Bay of Bengal. They were only 163 kilometers away from the epicenter of the earthquake that triggered the massive tsunami of December 2004.
Yeah, I remember that one, yeah.
Yeah. And these are small islands, like a cluster of islands. They were completely washed out. At one point of time, a few of the islands were not even visible on the satellites. It was all just water. And the Nicobaris are the indigenous people of those islands. They're aboriginals, and they usually used to live on the coasts in these big beehive huts. All of them were washed away. 90% of the coconut plantations were gone. And a huge wave of aid kind of swept the islands after tsunami. So it was like the tsunami after tsunami that the film is trying to document.
And which year did you film that movie?
That's a long one. We wrote the proposal in 2008. We got it sanctioned in 2009. And we started the first schedule in 2010-11, second schedule in 2012. And the film got ready only in 2016. So it has been a very long process. The person who started the film is not the person who finished the film. We are two different... I'm a different person now. Things changed.
It was a journey for you, right?
It was a journey for us. Because what's the point of a documentary film... Yeah, it should change others, it should have an impact on others. But before that, what's the use if it doesn't change you? So it has been a long, intense process. Because we dealt with communities, we dealt with a worldview, we dealt with a way of life. And it kind of had its impact on us as filmmakers because we were that involved.
Yeah. So what did you learn from that? Or what was the biggest lesson?
The biggest lesson was... money is not the sovereign lord.
Nice.
And that was the biggest lesson.
So how, after 2004, almost after 10 years, did the indigenous people manage to recover themselves? Did they establish, did they manage to build the houses back, or they started to build a new way type of house, or they went back to their tradition?
That's a very interesting question, because after tsunami... there was a humongous pressure to do something, to help. And in the process of helping, 8,000 permanent shelters were built for the islanders, for the Nicobaris. While they were previously used to live in 381, these big beehive huts. So imagine a population of three, which is housed in 381 beehive huts, is now split and spread into 8,000 permanent shelters. So imagine the impact that is there on their culture and social fabric just by the change in housing, which is given by the government, which is given by the administration.
How they take it?
Very difficult, because the entire socio-cultural fabric is changed. And the housing did not happen like this. It did not happen in a day. It took 5 years for the housing to get ready It took 5 years for the free ration. They were given free ration, mm-hmm. and it took five. And the free ration was stopped only after 5 years. So for the people of Nicobarese, had the Nicobarese had 5 years of free ration. They had housing built for them. They had people coming and giving compensation money. So it took at least half a decade and more for all of it to get out and for them to be living with themselves again. And that is the point where the film starts. Mm-hmm. When all the interventions are done, when all the aid agencies have done what they had to do and now moved out, and it's only for the first time now that the people are left to themselves to figure out what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the film starts then. So it is a critical question because it's very difficult to move back. So film is at a junction when the people are trying to decide the course of life, you know, the path, the direction,
mm-hmm.
which ways that they take. And
does
it's really complicated.
The film also talking about which path they took?
It's not the same for everyone mm-hmm. because it's a community.
Yeah.
And it's a community made up of smaller communities, just like Oroville. So different people took different paths, and it's very interesting. It's not a common path, or it's not a singular path that people take. Because there are generations, you know, younger generation wants something else. The older generation values something else altogether. Some people have the energy, you know, physical energy, and some people have the spiritual energy. So those people who have the spiritual energy not necessarily have the physical energy.
True.
People who have the physical energy not necessarily have the spiritual will. So it's a mix. Mm. It's really very fascinating the way the community is moving on.
So how the community looks now? Because before it was really indigenous, now it's probably a mixture of, let's say, civilized culture.
It is still very indigenous, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But the influences are there, very strong.
But that's destructive, no?
Well, nothing is destructive.
It's not?
Nothing is destructive. Everything is just building upon time.
No, I can imagine that, you know, if you implement the hardcore capitalism with all its consumerism, it for indigenous people who used to be sustainable by themselves, it can be destructive, no?
That is true. If you look at it that way, it is true because... Mm. But you cannot avoid it, can you? Can you avoid the advent of money? It has to come in at some point of time because, you know, because these forces are strong and powerful and widespread.
Mm.
They are going to go and capture every single territory that's available. It's just a matter of time. How long are you going to protect yourself and keep those barriers up?
Mm.
And in any case, Nicobarese were always exposed to the world outside. Imagine they are...
Because of the tourism, right?
Not tourism. Tourism is not allowed in the islands. But the act... The regulation, Andaman and Nicobar Protection of Aboriginal Tribes Regulation,
mm-hmm.
was implemented in 1956 after the independent India took over the islands.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, the islands and India itself was colonized.
Mm-hmm.
It was under the colonial rule. So before independent India and before the colonial rule, or during the colonial times, the islands were actually very much open to the world outside. Now, these are islands which are right in the center of Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
They happen to be right on an ideal trade route from the Far East Asia, from China, Rangoon, to Arab Persia. So there were many ships, traders, who used to pass through these islands, and they used to replenish themselves on these islands with coconuts. And as precious items like cotton, indigo, ivory are passing across the islands, the Nicobarese used to barter coconuts
mm-hmm.
for something as fancy as, you know, as empty alcohol bottles. Or silver coins, or a hat, or a coat.
Mm.
So that was the kind of interaction that the Nicobarese had. And you see, a lot of people have very interesting names, like Friend of England, or Mosquito, or...
Names, personal names.
Personal names, like nicknames. Nicknames mm. given to them by the people who used to pass by.
Mm.
And they were missionaries, you know. The Nicobarese, the islands have been... The Danish tried to colonize the islands in the 17th century. Then the Britishers did it successfully, but then there was Japanese invasion during the World War.
Mm.
So these influences were always there. And these are strategic islands. If you have control over the Andaman Nicobar group of islands, you practically have control over 270 degrees of Indian Ocean. So the India got independence in 1947, but the Britishers refused to give the charge. The Britishers gave the charge only in 1952, technically, mm-hmm. but practically they gave the charge only in 1956. And immediately the islands were protected by the Indian government mm-hmm. under this protection regulation. So the past 50 years, it was as if the Nicobaris were wrapped in a time capsule mm-hmm. Where there was no interaction from outside. So the development that the rest of the India had
forward, yeah.
Yeah, over the past 40, 50 years, that development was stalled for the Nicobaris and it was suddenly ushered post-tsunami mm-hmm. and it was squeezed in 5 years and given to them. So we who had 50, 60 years to attune ourselves to the moving times, the Nicobaris kind of had only 5 years. So the development, the advent of money, capitalism, these forces, it's not possible to stall them.
Yeah,
it's a matter of time.
Have you noticed maybe the psychological impact on the people? I can imagine that that can lead to depression, alcoholism, use of drugs and all kind of things, which is kind of destructive.
Yes, absolutely.
In a fast track, no?
Absolutely.
And imagine, how they cope with it? How do they, are they aware that actually they've been manipulated in a way? Because if somebody's telling you that you're supposed to consume this and you're supposed to buy that, and you fall for that trap, and then you just work to earn the money to buy those things, you're manipulated, right, by the money.
Exactly. Now, it is so. Mm. Imagine, but Nicobaris have always been, Nicobar is a land of plenty. Mm-hmm. They never knew what scarcity was. Mm-hmm. Earlier, it was like, whatever you want, you just give coconuts. As many coconuts as you wish. You want silver coins, you give coconuts. You want hats, you give coconuts. And the coconuts were never going to get over. Mm-hmm. When the money came, compensation money came, they never knew the idea of scarcity. They never thought the money would get over because the money came in like huge. Mm-hmm. 2 lakh rupees for a single person yeah. When they are not used to even a penny.
They're just dealing with coconuts, yeah.
Yeah, it's huge. But the money gets over. Mm. And it's a matter of time. And the money got over. Mm. But then they got used to buying bikes, buying mobile phones. Now there are bikes. The petrol gets over, the bike is hanging there. You know?
Really?
Yeah, the mobile phone, the charge gets over. They have no money to charge. The mobile phones are hanging in the house. The bikes are hanging like how the boats are hanged right in the center of the house. So it's like that. So they got addicted to things that money can buy, but they don't have means to make money because the coconut was the only way, it was the only cash crop, and the coconut is over. And not
all the coconut trees are gone.
90% of the coconut trees are gone.
They didn't reforestation with coconuts?
See, the coconuts used to be on the coastal areas. Yes. The coasts are gone. Up on the hills are tropical evergreen forests. Mm-hmm. So you really have to cut the forests or the grasslands. Now, they tried planting the coconuts on the grasslands. It's not possible. It's failure.
Yeah, yeah.
So the coconuts don't grow on the hilltops. Then you really have to go searching into the forest for the fertile patches where you can clear the forest patches mm-hmm. and make the coconuts grow. That's a humongous, long, huge effort process. So these are the tricky things.
I'm looking forward to tonight at 8 p.m. It's a screening, right?
It's at 9:30 p.m.
At 9:30 and just after the movie, it's a conversation with you, right? In mm-hmm. Cinema Paradiso.
Yes.
Now, there's another topic I would like to talk to you about is the art installation, because you and Ribu put old-fashioned TV sets in the lobby of Town Hall, yeah?
Yeah, I think it would have been great if the art installation happens, the talk happens with Ribu, because he's the mastermind behind it. So it's something that he envisaged and he's mm-hmm. extremely passionate about it. Mm-hmm. And
but you know what was his idea behind it?
Yes, because we've been working on it together. We came to Auroville and it was extremely kind of Joss, you know, mm-hmm. Joss Brooks of Pichandiculum, to show us the studio and to allow us to use the studio. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we are greatly indebted to him to welcome us in the studio and to give access to the footage that he shot over past 40 years. Mm-hmm. So when we came to Auroville in Pichandiculum and when we had that studio, we knew the amount of wealth that was in our fingertips, you know, mm. the amount of footage that he shot. over all these years.
So all this footage is running on the TV set?
Yeah, all this footage is, not all of it, because it's humongous. It's 6 to 8 TB. We have only managed to process 80 GB.
Mm.
And within 80 GB, we've managed to extract about 1.5 to 2 hours.
Mm.
So the idea was that all the work that went in, all the labor and all the designing idea that went into making Auroville the city that it is today, is captured by few people in their zest, you know, time when the time was building up. And we thought that if we have access to all of that, why not process it and why not put it up? You know, why not create like this Auroville timeline where, you know, we put up the television sets, 50, 80, 90, 100 of them, you know, where we use TV sets as photo frames and the videos as moving image running into it. So that's a big idea which we want to do eventually. But to begin
with... The TV sets are not available anymore.
Yeah, it started with 5. 50, 80 is in dreams. We hope it realizes, you know, someday. But the footage is there. We are processing the footage every single day. And we hope to make it big, where we kind of hope to create a video wall where, you know, we start with the old television sets, and with the technology improves, the texture of the image also changes. And from then to now, we kind of see the transformation of Auroville and the change in landscape, you know, as you walk from one end to the other.
That's a really great idea, yeah. I hope you will make it one day.
Maybe
next film festival in 2 years. Yeah.
Maybe in February, you know, when it's 50th years of Auroville, we really kind of managed to put up at least 50 television sets and all the footage and all those faces and those hands and feet that soiled themselves, you know, trying to build up. If we manage to put it up, you know, it's like a tribute. Right, yeah. It's like a tribute to the old ones. So
the day is going to be long, so let's finish for now.
Hope
to see you in some other occasion.
Yes, and thanks for having us here and to give us this space, because it's important to be able to reach out and to be able to connect.
Sure.
And thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.